is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Kyle Cavanaugh from Essential Coaching, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its play bank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at hoopheadspod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content. Coach, do you struggle with building a championship culture, getting your players to communicate on the court, maximizing your practice time, and bringing out the best in all your players? We all struggle in at least a few of these areas. And that's why over 1,500 coaches a year from all levels of play attend a summer or fall PGC course to learn these things. And coaches consistently say spending a week at PGC is the most useful and beneficial investment they've ever made in their coaching career. At your PGC course, you'll attend all the classroom, video, and court sessions, just like the players. If you're ready to take your coaching and your team to new heights next season, go to pgcbasketball.com, find a summer or fall course near you, and sign up. That's pgcbasketball.com. Hello, and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host, Jason Sunkel. And we are going to, despite our best intentions of jumping on after every finals game, or at least a finals game.
Listen, I'm not to blame for this one, Mike. I'm not to blame for this
one. I understand. I am not casting aspersions on you in any way.
I know. I'm just saying.
You were there. You were ready.
I was ready to go all quiet on the Western Front here at 11:30 at night, so I'm good to go. But it's all right. It's all understandable. We have lives, okay? We have lives, and if we were making millions of dollars podcasting, Mike, I think we would have been able to figure it out.
We probably could have carved out 20 minutes, but nonetheless, we are going to talk some NBA finals tonight. We're probably going to talk a little bit of NBA draft. And at the very end, we may touch on just a couple of free agency things that have caught our attention in the last few days. And then eventually, in the next week or two, we will get to NBA free agency and take a deeper dive into that. But let's start by going back to the NBA finals. Just thoughts on the Warriors win, big picture, small picture, wherever you want to start.
The big picture that I want to talk about is not even Steph's legacy. I've heard on several podcasts debated, should we consider the Warriors team a dynasty? My answer is yes. The three main players have been there for all four. Okay. Steve Kerr has been the head coach for all four. I can't understand how anyone could seriously make an argument that this is not considered a dynasty. I understand that there were 3 years in between championships. I get that. But this is a dynasty. It's kind of almost like, you know, maybe, you know, like the Bulls won three and then they took a few years off and then they won three more. And we consider that a dynasty. It's not two separate dynasties, right? This is a dynasty.
No.
This team is a dynasty. I can't fathom anyone making the argument that they're not. They've won four championships in the span of what? 15,
8 years.
8 years. Okay, they've won half the championships. It's a dynasty. Okay, and two of those years, by the way, their two main players were hurt or severely hampered. So if they were healthy, they probably would have been right there too. That's my stance, Mike, and I'm going to stick to it. It's a dynasty.
The argument against it that I've heard raised by people both on podcasts and in articles that I've read is that those intervening 2 years when Klay is down with the Achilles and the torn ACL, and then Steph is out the entire season, and then they win 15 games. You basically have two seasons where not only are they not in contention, but they're 1 year they're objectively awful and among the worst teams in the league. And then last season they make the play-in and get beat by the Grizzlies, and they come back this year and they win the title. So 4-8 to me, I would agree with you. I think it is a dynasty. I think it's interesting to look at how this dynasty came together when you think about, okay, they get that first one in 2015 over the Cavs, who are without their second best player and their third best player with Love and Kyrie being injured. Then in 2016, they win 73 games and don't win the title, blow the 3-1 lead. Then Durant comes, they win two. Durant leaves, Klay's hurt, Curry gets hurt, misses an entire season. Then somehow these guys kind of rejuvenate themselves and catch, in my opinion, quite a few breaks. Not that all title teams don't catch breaks, but I think Golden State caught some breaks this year with the way the injuries played out and just the fact that they ended up seeing Boston in the finals instead of seeing Milwaukee. But nonetheless, they got it done without Durant. So you have these bookend titles of two Curry teams sandwiched around those two Durant titles, which you've heard people argue, well, Durant changes that. Blah, blah, blah. There's just a whole bunch of arguments going back and forth, and I'm not sure what any of it really means. I don't know what the point of it is. Was Durant the best player on those two teams? I would probably argue yes. But was Curry, again, any less important to what Golden State does? We've talked about it a lot during this playoff run, just how his impact on the game, even when he's not shooting, is so huge because of the defense and the defensive attention that he draws. And he just makes things so much easier for everybody. And I'm sure if you think back to those years, he made things easier on Durant, just like Durant made things easier on him. And so I think you're right when you say four titles in 8 years, where four of the five main characters, if you want to include Durant, four of the five main characters did not change. And the guys who were responsible for putting the culture, putting the identity in place were there for all 8 years. I think Durant got plugged into the identity rather than help to establish a different identity. Like, I don't think this team was fundamentally different in their approach or the way they played while Durant was there. Obviously, Durant gave them a whole another dimension.
Yeah,
right,
yeah.
A whole other dimension. But still, it wasn't like they changed the offensive system or things looked different when Durant was there. It was just that instead of having a guy who was an average shooter, instead of having Andrew Wiggins, who was unbelievable in this series, you had Kevin Durant, arguably one of the top 10 to 15 players in the history of the league, sitting there in that spot instead of having a Wiggins or a Harrison Barnes. And so I think you have to consider it a dynasty 4-8 years. And does this team have another championship run in them moving forward? I think you look at it and you have to say Steph has showed really no signs of slowing down. You have to think Klay is going to be better.
Yeah.
Next year, I mean, look, he's getting older, so maybe the combination of him getting a little older with those injuries versus him coming back and rehabbing those injuries, maybe he's better. Maybe those two things cancel each other out, and he kind of is what he is this year, is kind of the version you're going to have of him. but I would tend to think he's probably going to get at least a little bit better. Draymond's probably on the downside, but he still does a lot of things that can help a team win under certain circumstances. The ownership group has proven that they're willing to spend money. I think Wiggins has one more season left on his current deal, so they'll probably talk extension here in the offseason. They've got all these young guys who I don't know if they're going to be good or not good or what they're going to end up doing with those guys, but they certainly have a treasure trove of assets that if they wanted to go out and package those guys into something that could help them immediately, a veteran guy, they could do that, which they kind of resisted the temptation to do that this year, or maybe just wait for James Wiseman to develop. And you hope that Moody and Kuminga continue to improve and get better. And maybe in the next year or two, those guys become major contributors. And now you don't need to look for veteran help off the bench because you've got these guys who are on these rookie scale contracts. And now that's the team that's filling in around Steph. I just think that this has been a really interesting 8 years because you do it at the beginning where it's brand new and that group wins an NBA record 73 games, doesn't win the title that year. Then Durant comes and they become probably the best team. I would argue probably the best team in the history of the league. I think in 2017, that first Durant year, I think you can make that argument. And then to win this title, to me, really is what cements the idea that this is a dynasty. Because I think if you just look at the five-year run from 2015 to 2019, when they make all those finals in a row, I think most people would say they probably should have won more, even though you could probably also make an argument that maybe they should have won less if Kyrie and Love were healthy in 2015. Maybe they don't win that one. But I think this one is the one that pushes them over to the top where, as you said, I think it's really hard to argue that they're not a dynasty.
Yeah, it's really hard to argue that. And so did you see Michael Thompson's tweet?
I did not.
Michael Thompson says that the Warriors should send the ring to Minnesota because they passed on Steph and Klay in the draft and then they traded Wiggins to Golden State.
I guess members of the Timberwolves organization at that time could get like a pseudo, like a half ring or something. Maybe
Con,
not quite.
Right? It had to be Con, yeah, right?
maybe not quite as gaudy as the actual championship ring, but maybe they get a toned down version of it. Yeah. Passing on Steph twice in the draft was kind of amazing. Although again, they picked Rubio and then Johnny Flynn. I think Rubio, you could certainly understand. Rubio was a household name even here in the United States by the time he was 17 years old, just from watching him play in international competition against the U.S., everybody thought that Rubio was going to be good. And the one knock on him was that he wasn't a shooter. And obviously the game moved in a direction away from his strengths. But we saw with the Cavs this year how good Rubio is. I don't think you can look at that mistake, that pick in that moment at number five and say that was an abject disaster.
It's like
of
the Olajuwon pick over Jordan,
right?
Right.
I mean, it's worse than that because Olajuwon's an all-time, I mean, he's probably a top 15 player of all time. So that pick is clearly defensible.
I mean, I'm saying it's a parallel to it. It's kind of
right.
The same
right. There's something similar. Like Rubio's not a complete bust. I don't think he was ever as good as what people thought potentially he could be. But we saw his impact on the game with the Cavs this year, that his basketball instincts and IQ and his ability to run a team, that was not a bad pick. That was not a bad pick in the moment. I think the Johnny Flynn one made less sense at the time. But look, there was not a consensus at the time when that draft happened that Steph Curry was going to be a perennial all-star and an all-NBA type guy. I don't think anybody necessarily saw that coming. Now, with the pedigree of his dad and his ability to shoot the ball, maybe people should have seen it coming, but he was underwhelming as an athlete. He was skinny and small. He was playing at a school that was not a Power Five conference school at Davidson. And so I think people, in a lot of ways, rightfully so, right? You're trying to project what these guys are going to be. We'll talk about it in a little bit when we get to the draft. It's an unknown. We're going to talk about guys in the top 10, and there's going to be two, three, four of these guys that seem like surefire successes, and they're going to end up not being very good in the NBA. And conversely, there's going to be guys lower in the draft that somebody's going to get a steal in the 20s or in the teens that's going to end up being an all-star player. It's just, it's an inexact science. But I guess the fact that they passed on him twice is what's is what's funny.
Yeah. And then the other, I guess the other thing we could talk really quickly before we talk Steph, Kenny Atkinson deciding to stay with Golden State. You know, we haven't obviously talked about that, but he was like, you know what? I don't want to coach that ball kid. Like I don't want to go to the Hornets. I want to stay here. It's a better fit for me. I think it's interesting because obviously Kenny Atkinson is widely regarded as probably one of the best coaching minds. I know he's never really won anything other than when he's not an assistant coach, but having him on the bench definitely helps the Warriors. And apparently he just didn't want to go to Charlotte, and I don't know. Can you blame him? I mean,
is that an indictment on Charlotte's organization and Jordan as an owner? Is that an indictment on he doesn't want to coach LaMelo? I don't know what it is that caused him to have second thoughts and doubts and pull his name out of consideration for that job.
It wasn't consideration. Certainly, he had taken the job.
Well, he had taken the job, right. I'm just saying. But pulling out of taking that job, did Golden State offer him a bigger compensation package where his salary as an assistant at Golden State is close to
probably
whatever he might have earned in Charlotte? And you're looking at it going, man, as the assistant coach, I don't have to deal with X, Y, and Z, and I'm earning 80% of the salary that I might have made as a head coach. It still seems like there had to be some kind of red flag because there's only 30 NBA head coaching jobs in the league, and there are lots of people lining up for the opportunity to get any of them. So for a guy to turn it down, be interesting to be able to pick his brain and see what it was. Again, was it the organization? Was it LaMelo? Was it the overall personnel in the roster? You wonder what it was that ultimately scared him off and caused him to go back to Golden State. And clearly, look, I think one of the things that you can think about when it comes to coaching, when it comes to being a player, when it comes to life, right, is the situation isn't always greener on the other side. And maybe he just looked at it and said, wow, I've got a great thing going here in Golden State. And as long as I'm happy here and my family's happy here and things are going well, maybe it's not worth uprooting my entire life just so I can be a head coach in a situation where maybe he just didn't believe that he could win. Maybe he didn't believe that the organization was going to put the resources into the team that they needed to. Maybe he didn't believe that LaMelo was the kind of player that could eventually lead a championship team. Who knows what went on after he initially accepted the job. But yeah, interesting that he went back to Golden State for sure.
Yeah. All right. So let's just talk Steph now. Steph wins the MVP. Does this put him, like, when we talk about the greatest of all time, in your mind, is he a top 10 player? I still think I have him at 15, like in the top 15. I'm not ready to say top 10 yet. I don't know what he has to do to get to the top 10, but I still don't know what. And I think this is something we have to revisit in a few weeks. I think we have to, like, this probably warrants a bigger discussion. Who is our top 10? And I know we did it last year, but it's probably a worthwhile episode in like August or something for us to sit down and say, who's our top 10 or 15 players of all time? Do you think he moves into your top 10 with this, or is it something you haven't really thought about, or what do you think, Mike?
Okay, so here's where I come at this question. I think this is where the hesitancy to put Steph into the top 10 in all time, I think this is where the hesitancy comes from. If you look at that list and you make a list of whatever, go to the top 15, top 20, the guys that you'd be considering with Steph, everybody ahead of him was in some way, shape, or form bigger or more physically imposing or had some type of athletic gifts that Steph just doesn't have. He's not going to overpower you. He's not going to jump over you. He's not 100 times quicker than you. He just doesn't have the physical characteristics of the guys that are ahead of him on the list. So start putting together that list. Magic, a 6'9 point guard. Jordan, one of the greatest athletes of all time, Bill Russell, Wilt, Oscar Robertson, I mean, LeBron, Shaq, Olajuwon. Just you think about the guys who are going to beat
Jordan,
Kobe.
Mike?
Kobe. I said Jordan.
Did you say Jordan?
I said Jordan. So I guess what I'm getting at here is that when you look at Kareem, Duncan, these guys are all guys that have like physical tool, Bird. They have physical tools that their size just allows them to do things that an ordinary NBA player just didn't have the ability to do. And Steph is much more, and I think this is what has always been his appeal with kids and why people like watching him play, is because he doesn't look the part of an overwhelming, unbelievable NBA athlete. Now, his eye-hand coordination, his stamina, and physical conditioning are second to none. But those are things that are not as readily apparent when you just stand next to him or you just watch him for 3 minutes or you see him warming up. He doesn't look like an overwhelming physical specimen the way most of these guys, or I should say all of these guys in the NBA's current top 10. So I think that clouds the way we look at it. And so when I think about it, obviously his argument starts and ends with his shooting, which there's never been anybody who shoots the ball even remotely close to as well as Steph shoots it. You're talking about catch and shoot threes. You're talking about threes off the dribble. You're talking about shots from 6, 7, 8 feet behind the line. He's basically ushered in a new era of basketball where pre-Steph, who's shooting threes off the dribble? Almost nobody. Almost nobody.
Now everyone's doing it.
Who's shooting shots on a regular basis from 5, 6, 7, 8 feet behind the line? Again, nobody. And so that's a change that he's made in the game as a result of the skills that he's brought to it. And you can look at his numbers and where he's going to be and when he ends his career. And look, he's, I think, just like LeBron, he's going to have a long peak where I still feel like he's going to be the Steph Curry that we know for the next 2, 3, 4 years. And he's going to continue to put up big numbers as long as he doesn't get hurt, injured. I think he's better than he's ever been going to the basket. He's got more different ways of finishing than he's ever had in his career. And so when I start thinking about him as a top 10 player, to me, again, it begins and ends with the shooting, which is revolutionary. And if you look at some of the guys in the top 10, you think about Kareem, they outlawed dunking because of Kareem at UCLA. You think about Wilt, they had to widen the lane in order to control where Wilt was able to post up because he was just so physically dominant. And you think about Steph changing an era. You think about Bird and Magic and the fact that they were both 6'9 guys who they were pass first. And when they came into the league, it was known as a selfish league of guys that didn't want to share the ball and were all offense. And there was this perception, and those guys changed and made team basketball popular and fun again. And so I think these guys in the top 10, they're all players who not only were they great players, but they also had an impact on the way that the game was played. So Steph has definitely done that. And I think I think that he's right there. And you look at the guys who probably are going to be talked about in that spot for number 9, number 10, number 11. You're talking about Shaq. You're talking about Kobe. You're talking about Jerry West. You're talking about Oscar Robertson. Is he squarely in that conversation? I think, yes, he's squarely in that conversation. I know you've probably heard the same talk that I have, that is he the best point guard of all time? We talked about it before that I'm not convinced that he's really a point guard, because to me, his best skill is still shooting. Now, he does have an impact, as we've talked about over and over again, on all his other teammates, not only with his passing, but just the way that teams have to defend him. But I don't think he's in the Magic Johnson discussion when you start talking about point guards. Magic at 6'9 and his passing ability and the things that he did to lead his team. To me, Magic's in a class by himself as a point guard, but that is in no way diminishing what Steph has been able to do. And as the greatest shooter of all time, I think with another couple years under his belt, I think he eventually ends up as a top 10 player. I'm not sure he can get past 9 or 10, no matter what he does, but I think ending his career as a top 10 player is definitely realistic at this point.
Okay, I agree. So I think that's an episode that we should put together in August.
I like it.
Going through our top 10, 15 players of all time. And we don't have to do it by position if we do it that way. It's not an all NBA team. It's just our top 15 players. And then I don't have to get yelled at about my positionally challenged.
You can't go positionally. You had some trouble last time understanding the positions.
Oh yeah, well, I was trying to cheat.
Is there any other current player? Obviously LeBron. Is there any other current player that has a chance of sniffing the top 15? I think there's probably Durant. Two, right? Durant and Giannis. I think those are the two. Giannis is not there yet just because of the longevity of his career, but if he continues on the same track that he's been on, I think that he's going to be a guy that's going to have an opportunity to get up there. He's got to win a couple more titles probably, honestly, to get to the top 10, and probably needs to add even an MVP, but he's going to be right there by the end of his career, because I just think he's going to be a guy that's going to keep working. So,
yep.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Quickly all talk right. Celtics.
I don't know, five
minutes on the Celtics.
I don't know that I have 5 minutes of things to say. They are what they are. I mean, we've talked about it at length. What did we say at the Tatum is not the best player on a championship team, at least not right now, his current iteration. He was terrible in parts in the series, and he had flashes of brilliance, but you knew what you were getting with him, and you knew you couldn't count him in the stretch. And he turned the ball over 100 times in the playoffs. He's the first player in NBA history to have 100 turnovers in a single playoffs. Now, I understand that they played a lot of games, but they also only had a 4-game series the first round. So they had having 100 turnovers, that's crazy. I mean, for as many times as we heard, LeBron gets careless with the ball, or so-and-so gets careless with the ball, and the amount of times that LeBron's been in the playoffs and made it to the finals, like, 100 turnovers, that's a lot, Mike. That's a lot.
When you're not – and look, Tatum had the ball a lot in his hands, and because this team doesn't have a traditional point guard that's running the team, he's got to do a lot of playmaking, but it's not like he was LeBron just having the ball constantly and having every single thing that happened flow through him. I mean, the offense is still moving and the ball, eventually it's finding him. But yeah, it's too many turnovers. And you look at his statistics, he shot 36% from the field in the finals, shot 65% from the line. And I think if you talk to any Celtics fan, they were left wanting and they were left wondering. And I think they had the same questions that you and I asked on the last podcast was, do you trust that Tatum is going to have a big game in Game 5 or Game 6? And I kept saying, no, I don't feel like it's inevitable that he's going to have a great game. I didn't feel like I could sit there and say, okay, tonight let's pencil Tatum in for 30 and 11 rebounds. I just, look, there's very, 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 very few guys in the history of the game that you can do that with. So it's no knock on the fact that Tatum is not, we're not saying that Tatum's a terrible player. We're not saying that Tatum's not a great player, but he may not be, at least as you said, at this point, he's not that, hey, just pencil him in. I don't care what the situation is. He's going to get you 30 and 10 because he's just that good. And he's not at that point. Look, he beat Milwaukee with game six in Milwaukee when he put up 46 on the road. Probably one of the best performances in a clutch situation for a team that needed it. That's a really, really, really great game. That's a historically great game. But it still felt like in any given night, I don't know if that guy is showing up. And I think that's the real true mark of superstardom. When you start talking about those guys that we mentioned earlier that are in the top 10 or the top 15 or the top 20, those are the guys that you just pencil them in. You know what their impact is going to be in a given game. And I just don't feel like we ever got there with Tatum. So I think the question with Boston is, to me, the biggest thing is, do they need a point guard? And do they need somebody who down the stretch can get them organized, can make sure that the ball is getting to the right people? And I think Marcus Smart was tremendous this year and obviously the defensive player of the year. Offensively, I still think that he thinks he's better than he is. And I don't know that down the stretch of clutch moments that he's the guy that can get you organized and get you a good shot in those clutch moments. So
all
to me,
good shots are just not the right player shooting the shot.
Right, right. But I think Smart, yeah, look, Smart's a good player. I would want him on my team. I would want him on my team, but I'm not sure that
you
I would want
more
him
running
as
the show at the in this in the clutch
yeah,
moments.
I'd like to have another guy, like somebody in that Derek White role who was more of a point guard, more of a guy who could kind of take charge. Like, I think, you know who'd be great for this team? Ricky Rubio.
Oh, no, don't say that.
Kyrie Irving would
be a great fit for his team.
Kyrie Irving is not going back to Boston. Let's cross Boston off the list of potential Kyrie destinations right now. So I think if I was Boston, I would look for a high quality backup type point guard who I felt like could run the show for me. I think it's Tyus Jones from Memphis. Is he a free agent this year? Like Tyus Jones would be perfect for the for the Celtics. I'm not sure if he's a free agent this year or next year. I'm kind of flipping through my list here. But anyway, Tyus Jones is a free agent. Like if Boston could somehow sign Tyus Jones, to me that would be a guy who would be a perfect fit. He's not going to make a max type salary, but he's going to be a guy that can get your offense organized and maybe make your team better and just give you a different look than maybe what you had this year. So if I'm Boston, that's where I go. And then, look, you got to get better internally. Jaylen Brown was good, but he definitely has some weaknesses handling the ball and driving into traffic and playmaking. He's proven over the course of his career that he can get better, and he's a guy who works at his game, so I would expect him to continue to improve. Look, is there that superstar like we've been talking about? Is that somewhere lurking inside of Tatum, who's only 24? When he's 27, is he a guy maybe who you do say, hey, we can pencil this guy in for 30 and 10? Maybe. I don't think he's there yet. So I think that internal improvement, and then to me, the biggest thing with Boston is they need somebody to help them get good shots and steady their offense in the last 3 or 4 minutes of big games, which I don't think they did a very good job of this year.
I agree. And I don't know. I don't know. You know, like Boston's picking. What are they picking in the draft here? They're not picking. Oh, they don't have a first round pick. Oh, at all. Also, you know, they don't have a first round pick. They have their first pick is not until 53. So they can't rely on the draft to get that guard either. So they've got to do something. They've got to do something because I'm just going to say Marcus Smart is not the answer. Like you said, you can't rely on him to organize an offense in a manner that's going to lead to winning baskets down the stretch, because he's just going to chuck up a three, but he did have some nice green hair, Mike. I will give him some credit. Give him
the
some
green
credit
hair
for
the was
green
hair. The green hair was pretty funky.
Yeah. All right, so I think we're going to now transition to the draft a little bit, Mike. The draft is in 2 days. I'll be completely honest with you when I say, other than like the top three, I really don't know much of anything about some of these guys. Like, I've heard some of these names. I know the Cavs have been linked with. I don't necessarily know if that would be a good pick for the Cavs. And obviously, it's going to really depend on how the rest of the draft plays out. But I guess the question is, and I believe I saw somewhere, I think J.J. Redick said that he is certain that the Orlando Magic are going to take Jabari Smith. He is, like, locked in that that's who they're going to take. Now, I don't know if he knows someone within the organization or if he's just saying that, but it sounds like Jabari Smith is going to be the first pick. When you look at it, really, there's three players I feel are the top three players, right? Jabari Smith, Chet Holmgren, and Paolo Banchero. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. That seems to be the consensus, that those three guys are clearly sort of in a tier by themselves.
Yeah. So, Chet is interesting to me. He's the most intriguing one out of the three. But
let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Let's do it this way. If it was the Cavs drafting number one, and I don't care, not necessarily this Cavs team, but just if your team or you are an Orlando Magic fan, what would be your preferred order? I think that's the best way to
I'll be honest with you, Mike, this question. And this is going to be completely out of left field. I'd probably take Banchero, and here's why. Because he's coming from Duke, and I know that he's going to be ready to play in the NBA. Tell me a player from Gonzaga that has had any impact in the last 10 years.
Adam Morrison?
Tell me a player from Auburn. Now, the last 10 years. You can't go way back.
I can't go back to Barkley?
No, I knew you were going to go there.
Chris Morris?
I'm just saying, I think I probably would lean to take him, even though the other two guys, you know, might have intangibles at Banchero. I just know that Banchero is going to be ready to go because it's Duke. And maybe that's a terrible idea. Maybe I'm not basing this on basketball ability or anything. I'm basing it on the fact that this guy is probably the most ready out of those three to play in the NBA, primarily because that he played for Coach K. He played in a program that has produced time and time again quality and great NBA players.
All right, so you would go Banchero. Who's two?
I probably would go Holmgren, and then put Smith three. And like I said, I'm not basing this based on all just if I was right, basing I it solely on build ability, I'd probably put Smith one, Holmgren two, Banchero three. But I'm flipping Banchero and Smith because I feel like Duke is going to prepare him for the NBA. If you need someone that's going to make an instant impact right away, and Orlando needs that because they're terrible.
I love the anti-Gonzaga argument. That's one that I hadn't thought of, but it's 100% accurate.
I mean, name it. They've been terrible. Every player that's come out of Gonzaga that's drafted, I'm going to pull up a list, Mike, and I'm going to say their names. So you go say what you're going to say, and I'm going to say – right. I'm going to have the list
I know ready. I know this list is not going to be good, so yeah. Look, I think when you're talking about these three guys at the top of the draft, each one of them is a different type of player. Each one of them has a different type of ceiling. And that's what makes it so interesting. So if you think about Chet Holmgren, you're talking about a guy who defensively is just so long and has proven at every level that he's played, including internationally, that he's a fantastic shot blocker with great timing, huge long wingspan. And yet you look at his body and he's so skinny. And it just feels like guys like that have not been stars. They've been oddities. Now, Holmgren is much more skilled than Sean Bradley or Manute Bol or guys that have that type of body. But it's still hard to look at him and say that with that frame that he's going to be able to be physically imposing in the league. Now, he might be able to block shots, and he might be able to space the floor, and he might be able to pass, but in order to reach his potential, he's going to have to fill out and put on a lot of weight to become a guy who, when we think of what a number one pick is, a guy that you can center your offense around, a guy who's going to be ball dominant, a guy who's going to do everything on the floor. It's hard to imagine that Holmgren is going to get, it's hard for me to imagine that Holmgren's going to get there. Now, he probably has the widest array of skills when you consider offense and defense of these three guys. He probably checks more boxes than both of them if he reaches his potential. But to me, that frame makes me worried. So I think Chet is probably the most well-rounded player, but yet at the same time, I think he's also the guy who maybe is the least likely to get to his best case scenario. I think his best case scenario might be the best, but I think he's got the least chance of getting to that.
Uh-huh.
If that makes sense.
Okay. So players drafted since Adam Morrison from Gonzaga.
Okay. I'm ready.
Austin Day, Robert Sacre, Kelly Olynyk. This is, the next player is by far the best player, Sabonis. I forgot that he even went to Gonzaga. I wouldn't have known Domantas Sabonis went there. Nigel Williams-Goss, Zach Collins, Brandon Clark, Rui Hachimura, Filip Petrušová, Corey Kispert, and Jalen Suggs.
So you have some decent NBA careers. You have Olynyk. Brandon Clark is a good player for Memphis, going to continue to be a good player for a long time. I think the jury's still out on Cody Kispert. The jury's still out on Suggs, but neither one of them came into the league and suddenly lit it on fire.
Yep.
So, and yeah, I think it's a point well taken.
And then I'm going to make the same argument for Auburn, okay? They've only had 5 players taken since 2009 in the draft, Mike.
Okoro.
Okoro's one of them. Chuma Okiki. Sharif Cooper.
Orlando. Okay.
JT Thor. And Davion Mitchell. When Wesley Person is the 10th most recent person drafted out of your school.
Yeah, that you're not an NBA player factory at that point.
And the guy after that is Muchie Norris. I like that name.
Muchie Norris. That's a good Muchie Norris point guard. I like Muchie.
Yeah. Anyways, so I'm just saying, like, those two places are not, and I don't need to pull up the Duke one. We all know there's so many players.
Yeah, Duke's produced a ton of guys clearly.
That's my argument.
Okay, so all right. Here's what I think. I think Chet Holmgren in the NBA, I don't think he ever gets to his ceiling of being a do everything guy who has an impact on both ends of the floor, and he's the best player on your team. I think Chet Holmgren is going to end up being a very, very good high level role player in the NBA, and role player is maybe even too. That might not be strong enough. Maybe he's better than that because I think he's going to have a wide variety of skills and be able to have an impact on both ends of the floor. But I don't ever see him be the guy on your team. I just don't think that that's who he is. I think he's going to fill gaps, and I think he's going to be a very good player. I don't think he's going to get to his potential. Jabari Smith, a guy who can shoot it, a guy who's versatile defensively, who's long, who's athletic, more athletic than either of these other two guys in terms of what we think of as athleticism, a guy who can jump, who can run, who's got great timing. He's a guy, again, who can have impact on both ends of the floor. But at this point in his career, he doesn't really put the ball on the floor and dribble and create for anyone else. He kind of needs to be set up, or he's a one dribble pull up type of guy. And playmaking is something that I think guys either have it or they don't. Can you get better at it? Yes. But if you don't have that passing gene, that ability to create for others, I don't think you really develop it at an elite level. So I'd be worried again that if I'm drafting Jabari Smith, I'm drafting a guy who maybe his ceiling is second best player on a really good team. Now, most teams at the top of the draft, you can get the second best player on a championship team. You're probably going to be pretty happy with your draft. But that's where I see his ceiling being. And I could see him getting to that. I could see him getting to that ceiling because he's such an elite athlete and he's such a good shooter at 6'10". And then Banchero, the thing with him is he's probably the most skilled offensively, at least for sure at the moment, compared to these other two guys. He's the most ready to come into the NBA and sort of be that player that you'd envision at number one simply because of his body. But he also is a guy who is not the fast, twitchy, rangy, super athlete like we think of when we think of guys like LeBron or Giannis or Kobe, these guys who dominate physically because of their athleticism. Banchero's not necessarily that guy. I've heard a lot of comparisons to Blake Griffin, where Blake Griffin was super athletic, but Blake Griffin, not long arms, not a great wingspan, not a guy who was twitchy in traffic defensively, didn't protect the rim. I think that's kind of what Banchero is. And so if you draft him, you're probably giving up something on the defensive end. And I think one of the things that when I think about the draft now, I always try to think about the way that teams play in the playoffs, right? If you are a poor defensive player, even if you're one of the best offensive players, teams are going to find you and they're going to hunt you and they're going to find ways to exploit you if you're not a top-notch defender. And that's not to say that Banchero couldn't develop into being a good defender, but he's not going to be the kind of long, lengthy, fast twitch defender that some of these other guys maybe can be and some of the guys in the league are. And so I think if you're taking Banchero, you might end up taking a guy who's a really good offensive player, but who might end up being a defensive liability at the highest level. So all that being said, if it was me, I think I would roll the dice at number one. I think I'd roll the dice with Chet only because he has the potential with all his wide range of skills. I think he could potentially have the most impact on your team in so many different ways. And if he got to his ceiling, which I think there's a pretty low probability of that, but if he gets to his ceiling, I think he could be a superstar. Whereas I don't think those other two guys would ever reach the level of being the best player on a championship team. I don't think Holmgren will get there, but I'd be worried to pass that up. So if I was drafting, I would go Chet 1, I would go Jabari 2, and I would go Banchero 3.
Okay, fair enough, Mike. All right, and
so let's talk about how we think it's going to go, how we think it's actually going to go. How do you think it's actually going to go?
Who knows? I think Jabari's number 1. I think it's going to go Jabari, Chet, Paolo.
I agree. Yeah.
And then after that, who knows? I think the only other question that I wanted to ask you is, what do you think the Cavs are going to do? I guess because that's relevant to us.
I think they're going to do in terms of who they're going to draft?
Are we drafting at 14, or are we trading the pick?
I think they're drafting at 14 because I think if you look at this draft, I think there's guys that are going to be available in the range where they're picking that at least fit the profile of the type of player that the Cavs are looking for.
Like Okai Agbajad. I don't know how to say his last name. How do you say his name?
The kid from Kansas?
Yeah. The forward. That's who I want.
Agbaji.
That's who I want. I can't say his name. I'll learn to say his name. But I want him. Just because we need a forward. I don't want this guy. I don't want the Ohio State guard. We're not going to take a center.
Agbaji, height 6'4.5".
Maybe he's not tall enough.
Branham, 6'4".
How is he labeled? So how is Agbaji labeled as a forward?
I'm looking at the...
Yeah, it's not I'm a forward. 6'4 is not a forward in the NBA. Come on now.
It's got him listed as a wing. Branham's, they've got listed as a guard.
So that half of an inch makes a difference?
Half an inch, that's it, man. That's
man,
it.
Man, I'd be considered, if I had half an inch, I'd almost be considered a wing.
I read a couple things today that the Cavs have put out a guarantee or a promise to Usman Jang's camp that if he's available, that the Cavs are definitely taking him. That's the 6'10 dude out of New Zealand.
He's from France, isn't he?
But I think he played in New Zealand.
Oh, okay.
Played in New Zealand.
Did you see there's another Jop in this draft? draft is there? It's not Sagana's kid, though.
All right. Well,
did you know Sagana was on the bench for the Houston Rockets? Did you know that? He's an assistant coach for the Houston Rockets.
That's good. I did not know that. I did not know that.
Yeah. His name is, where is he at? This Diop guy. He's also from Senegal. Khalifa Diop.
All right. There you go. Nice.
Anyways, sorry. I think the Cavs need to get a full forward who can, like, I don't want to say a 3-and-D type guy because that's kind of cliche, but I kind of think like that's what they need, right? A 3-and-D type guy.
They need an offensive player who can also play defense. I don't know if that's a 3-and-D guy, but they need somebody who is a good defender, but who can also score from the wing position. I feel like we said it a lot during this past season that if Okoro were to come around as an offensive player, defensively, he's everything that you could want. And he goes to the hole hard. He plays hard. But he just – I don't know if that shot is ever going to come around to make him enough of a threat that he can be a 35-minute-a-game playoff player. I just – I'm not convinced that – that shot is ever going to come around. So the Cavs need a guy that could be on the floor that can knock down jump shots, because eventually as this team develops, clearly teams are going to be worried about Garland. And if Mobley continues on the trajectory that most people think that he's going to, he's going to draw a heck of a lot of double teams too. And so you're going to need a guy that can stand out there and bang home shots. And so is that Agbaji? Is that Branham? I don't know. Those are two guys that I think fit what the Cavs are looking for. Agbaji's probably a better defender than Branham. I'd say Branham's probably a better scorer, a guy who can put it on the floor, maybe a more dynamic scorer than Agbaji. But they both kind of fit the profile of what they're looking for. The other guys that I think would fit sort of in this same mold that I've seen him going higher than the Cavs. I've seen him dropping to the Cavs. Johnny Davis from Wisconsin, who is a guy, reminds me a little bit of Malcolm Brogdon in that he's strong and physical, but not necessarily a fast twitch, dunk on people type of athlete. He's more of a physical type of player as a guard. And then the other one is AJ Griffin from Duke, who score guy in the wing, 6'6". Really high high school pedigree, guy who was considered top 5, top 10 recruit coming out of high school and obviously had to sort of defer with that talented Duke team and maybe didn't get as many opportunities with his hands on the ball. But I think those four guys, Griffin, Agbaji, Branham, and Johnny Davis, are the four guys to me that if you could get one of them, I think you'd come out of there feeling pretty good. And then Jang, I have no idea. I mean, he might be good. He might not. I have no idea. I know he's been rising up draft boards as things have gone along here this spring, but I don't have anything to go on with him. So to me, he doesn't make as much sense positionally. But again, if he's got the potential to be an NBA star, then if you think he has that kind of ability, then you just draft him.
Okay. Fair enough. All right. Free agency, Mike, real quick.
Cavs question. Colin Sexton, is he on this team next year?
I think so.
I do too.
Kyrie Irving question.
Okay.
Does a team sign him for longer than a 3-year deal?
No. No.
I agree. Anyone that does would be stupid.
I think max he gets a 2-year. I think the best case scenario for Kyrie is a 2-year deal, maybe with a player option. I think it's much more likely that somebody signs him to a 2-year deal. Cause I think, look, I don't know. I haven't gone through team by team, which teams might be willing to absorb him and which teams might have the culture to absorb him, but nobody's going to want to commit long-term money to this guy. I just can't see it. And because he just doesn't play very often, you could say that maybe a team that's at a lower level might pick him up because he's a box office draw. He's a really popular player. Really popular player. But if he's only going to play in half your games, he he's probably not going to help your season ticket sales all that much if he's not going to be on the floor. So I'd say a 2-year deal is probably what he's going to get. Maybe a 2-year deal with a player option. I have no idea where he's going to go. I would be stunned at this point if he's back in Brooklyn.
Yeah, and the other thing that Brooklyn's hesitant to give him a long-term deal because they're worried that he's going to retire in the middle of it.
Look, there's why any team would be crazy. In all honesty, you might be crazy to give him a 2-year deal. Make him play it out 1 year at a time. But then you're talking about he almost has to go to a team that is in a championship frame of mind, and there's not that many of those teams. And then you look across the board and you're like, which championship level team would want to add a guy like Kyrie? Honestly, if Kyrie would buy in, the best fit for him, Dallas. If you got the best version, if you got the Cleveland version of Kyrie and you put him next to Luka, where when Luka's off the floor, Kyrie can do his thing. And when Luka's on the floor, Kyrie's spotting up and he's that secondary ball handler. You basically put him back in the exact same role that he had with the Cavs and LeBron. To me, that would make a ton of sense for both the Mavs and for Kyrie. Now, I don't think that'll happen. I don't think he's going to Dallas. But as I look around the league, if I could pick one landing spot for him where I think it could potentially work out unbelievably well, if it all went the way that the team would hope, I think Dallas would be the spot.
Interesting. I didn't hear that floated out by anyone. So
I think it would be a good fit. I don't know that the money makes sense. I don't know that they could do it. I heard him talking today on the NBA Today. I heard Zach Lowe and that crew, I think Wendy was on there, was talking about would Kyrie just opt out and then go play for the mid-level exception somewhere for somebody just to get whatever he felt was the best environment for him. And they were like, sure, we could see him doing that. He'd be the type of guy that, you know, he could be eligible to sign a $250 million supermax, and instead he just decides, hey, I want to go play with Luka in Dallas. I'm going to take the mid-level and go do that.
I want to go back to play with LeBron. That's the biggest joke I've ever heard in my life. Those two are never playing together. No.
I don't see that. Yeah, I don't see that. I don't see that happening in any way, shape, or form. So, yeah, I have no idea where Kyrie's going to go. But to me, as I just look around the league and thought about it off the top of my head, Dallas is a place that I think I could see him going. I'd like to see him go. And then as far as the Sexton question, I think he's going to be back on the team. I think you're going to look at – he had too good of a season the year before he got hurt. You look at his efficiency and the fact that he scored 24 a game. And I know you and I were critical of him and the fact that he's definitely a shoot first guy. And at 6'1 or 6'2, shoot first guys better be pretty special in a lot of areas in order for them to justify what they do. But I think the development of Garland and the addition of Mobley and Jared Allen continuing to improve, I think Sexton's too talented of a guy to just give away for a future draft pick. You're not getting a top 5 pick for Colin Sexton, so you're basically giving him away for maybe you get something in the 10 to 15 range. To me, the odds of you getting a better player in that slot than Colin Sexton are pretty small. And then we talked about it during the season. You also have Caris LeVert, and you look at both of those guys. Which one do you want? Which one's going to be part of your future? And maybe it's one of them. Maybe it's both of them. Maybe it's neither of them. But I think you take a look at it this year and figure out if either of those guys are part of your core moving forward. And obviously the core is Garland, Mobley, and Allen.
I agree. Okay. One more last question, Mike.
Sure.
John Wall, did you see? He opted into his contract.
Like surprising.
$47.4 million contract in Houston. Oh, my God. Houston, we have a problem.
Well, I think if you're Houston, you knew that was coming. And now you're in a position where John Wall is just on your books. He's on your roster. Last year, they didn't play him at all. Do you do the same thing this year where he just sits and doesn't play or Do you let him suit up and play on your team? I have no idea what they do with him. Untradeable. I guess you could never say somebody's untradeable. Maybe there's a Westbrook wall swap at some point because both teams are just sick of looking at the guy that they have on their bench and they'd rather look at somebody else. But no team is going to trade for John Wall at that salary price. So if you're Houston, I think you just do what you did last year and you continue to develop your young guys. You bring in whether it's Jabari or Chet or Paolo, whoever they end up getting at number three, and you just continue to build and see what you got with Jalen Green and Şengün and whoever their draft pick ends up being. And Wall just continues to sit until that contract is off your books, and then you can figure out where you go from there. So not surprising that he opted in.
I agree. All right. I don't have anything else. I don't have dad jokes or anything, Mike.
Let's leave it there.
Leave it there.
So next week we will be back on to talk about what happened in the NBA draft. We'll start talking more free agency. I'm sure there'll be more news and things that are going on. So the NBA silly season is upon us.
And silly season.
That always gives us lots of interesting things to talk about and to speculate on. So we hope you'll join us in the weeks ahead for our Wednesday editions of the Hoopheads Pod here where we talk NBA. This week's episodes, as far as our coaching interviews, on Monday we had Kent Dernbach, the head men's basketball coach at the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. Really good episode talking about his journey through coaching, different levels. Twice he was an interim head coach and eventually ended up at La Crosse, where he is building a very good program that's going to continue to compete at a national level. And then coming up on Friday, we have a local high school coach here in the Cleveland area from Menor High School. Guy's a legend. He's won two state titles at two different schools, Bob Krasancic. And Bob came out. He's got a new book about mental toughness. Really good book. And he talked a little bit about the book, a little bit about his career. And his teams play a very unique style. They run, they press, they shoot a lot of threes. Not that that's unique, but his teams are well known for that. And he just does a great job of getting his team to play within his system. And that interview was a lot of fun. So make sure you check those two out this week. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.